All right. So for almost 100 years now, I think that there has been a stain on the world's socialist movement. A stain so severe that when many people hear the word socialism, their first thought isn't of a truly liberated society run under the democratic control of the working class, but one of the many horrific dictatorships that ruled much of Eastern Europe throughout the Cold War. This is an image that is intentionally fostered and encouraged by the ruling class the world over, who see the legacy of Stalinism as a useful tool to demoralize and discredit anyone who would dare to fight for a better society. But it is also, unfortunately, an image that many on the left today shamefully continue to appeal back to. At best, glossing over and ignoring the worst abuses of these societies, and at worst, actively defending them as somehow having anything to do with the vision for socialism fought for by people like Marx and Lenin. Not only do I believe that Stalinism bears nothing in common with what these people fought for, I believe that, in the words of Russian revolutionary and chief opponent of Stalinism, Leon Trotsky, that between them lies not only a bloody line, but a whole river of blood. I'm going to spend a bit of time in my talk today discussing the origins of Stalinism in 1920s Russia and comparing the depths of the Stalinist vision for socialism with the inspiring heights of the 1917 Russian Revolution. But the primary focus of this session is actually going to be about the ramifications that Stalinist politics have had on the rest of the international socialist movement, both then and today. And in particular, the way that the socialist movement was turned into a cheer squad for the imperialist competition of various capitalist nations against one another. I hope that most people here went to the earlier session about the Russian Revolution or have some prior knowledge about it, because I'm not going to have space in this talk to give an in-depth timeline of what happened, but I do want to quickly refresh some of the key details. In particular, I want to stress the mass democratic nature of the revolution, which is either actively ignored or massively downplayed by both the right-wing and Stalinist historiographies of the revolution. Every single key event in the Russian Revolution was marked by an enormous degree of direct involvement, creativity, and democratic control by the working masses of Russia. From the very beginning of the revolution in February, it was marked by strikes and demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of workers protesting against the terrible conditions brought on by the war and demanding the downfall of the hated Tsar. In order to effectively organize this struggle, the workers re-established the Soviets, modeled off of a similar experience gained in the failed 1905 revolution. The Soviets, which is the Russian word for councils, were organizations of mass participatory democracy. Workers in the factories, soldiers in their regiments, and peasants in their village would directly elect delegates from amongst their own ranks to represent themselves. These delegates weren't rich lawyers or career politicians like we get stuck with all too often today. And unlike the sham democracy we all live under, where you get to choose between one ruling class parasite or another every 3 to 6 years, who then do whatever the hell they want in the meantime, with no oversight or responsibility to their voters, delegates elected through the Soviets received no special privileges and were subject to immediate recall by their comrades if they misrepresented them. But this spirit of radical working class democracy didn't just stop at electing some good delegates and then letting them decide everything. Decisions were made with the utmost participation by the masses themselves. Even when planning for things like the insurrection in October, which naturally requires some degree of secrecy regarding the specific events, the decision of whether or not the Soviets should seize power was made by the masses themselves. In the weeks leading up to the insurrection, there were a flurry of meetings and resolutions passed in the factories, the regiments, and the countryside calling for the Soviets to seize power. And in the days leading up to the insurrection, Trotsky tells a story of like just a week-long continuous meeting in Petrograd, where thousands and thousands of workers would cram into the meeting hall, debate and vote on the need for Soviet power, and then be replaced by another few thousand workers coming in to do the same. This was the beating heart of the Russian Revolution. It wasn't just about nationalization of the economy or the coming to power of a particularly enlightened political party of enlightened leaders. To quote Trotsky yet again, it was about the forcible entry of the masses into the realm of rulership over their own destiny. Alongside this radical democratization of society was a series of essential changes to the way that things were organized. The dictatorship exercised by the bosses was ended as democratically organized factory councils continually asserted more and more control over society. The subordinate role of women was challenged as the new workers' government legislated things like no-fault divorce, free abortion on demand, and communal kitchens, as well as state-run childcare in order to take the burden of the home off the backs of women. And the Soviet government immediately began to negotiate an end to the war and published all the secret treaties between Russia, Britain, and France, outlining their plans to carve up the world and expand their empires. The Bolshevik Party and the new Soviet government were extremely level-headed about what it would take for these gains to be cemented. They understood that socialism must come about as an international system, and that any revolution isolated to Russia alone would inevitably fail due to the constant pressure of being forced to compete with other capitalist states on the global market. As such, they established the Communist International, or the Comintern for short, in 1919, with the goal of bringing together revolutionaries from all across the world and helping guide and encourage them to best lead successful revolutions of their own. It was unfortunately on this basis that the revolution was to eventually fall short. It was initially greeted by a whole series of revolutionary upsurges across Europe, most notably in Germany, where the newly founded Communist Party soon found itself at the head of over 500,000 members. Unfortunately, despite the best efforts of revolutionaries across Europe and advice from the Comintern, the German Revolution was defeated in 1923, and the immediate prospect for international revolution to reinforce Russia was crushed. Simultaneously, the Russian Revolution was besieged on the home front by an absolutely brutal civil war, with the counter-revolutionary White Army receiving backing in the forms of arms, advice, and soldiers from over 14 different imperialist nations. The European ruling class was absolutely terrified of workers' power and intervened harshly in order to destroy the revolution. While this invasion was rebuffed and the workers' state survived the civil war on paper, the damage had already been done. Civil life was absolutely destroyed. Up to 12 million people, or 10% of the country's total population, died. The population of the cities in particular collapsed enormously, and the Soviets subsequently ceased to exist in any real sense. Rather than the state being fueled by the mass democratic participation of the working class led by the Bolsheviks, the party was forced to substitute itself for the working class and essentially take over the running of the state entirely. Over the course of the next few years, the party leadership became increasingly entrenched and bureaucratized. This bureaucratic layer within the top leadership of the party crystallized and solidified around Joseph Stalin, and he soon moved to crush his remaining political enemies, most notably with the expulsion and exile of Leon Trotsky from Russia in 1928. This downfall was far from inevitable. If revolutions in countries like Germany, Italy, France, or Britain had succeeded, they would have been able to send very desperately needed material support to Russia. Things like the food, the raw materials, and the factory components that it would have taken to rebuild the populations of the major cities and re-establish the Soviets. But the failure of these revolutions and the subsequent isolation of Russia doomed the revolution to a slow and agonizing death and paved the way for Stalin's rise. So what was life under Stalin actually like? Well, let's start with the obvious point that he was a brutal dictator who oversaw one of the most effective police states in the world in order to maintain a society of deep inequality and corruption. Gone were the days in which every street corner was a center for debate and discussion about the future of the revolution. To do so under Stalin would have meant attracting the ire of the secret police and risking being sent to the gulags or executed immediately. Estimates place the death toll of the Great Purges in the 1930s as somewhere between 700,000 to 1.2 million people, and anywhere from 2 to 10 million people were sent to slave labor camps, where many more died or were executed before ever being released. These purges and the general level of political repression in this period was not just about cementing the power of Joseph Stalin as an individual, though that was certainly a massive part of it, but were a part of the general destruction of all the remaining vestiges of the revolution. Since 1924, Stalin and the new Russian ruling class that emerged around him explicitly abandoned the idea of international revolution in favor of the idea of socialism in one country. What this represented in reality was the project of building a powerful nation state in order to compete with Western imperialist countries. This meant the reintroduction of a capitalist mode of production represented by the first five-year plan in 1928. The factory councils, which had stubbornly managed to survive up to this point, were dissolved, the unions were disempowered and destroyed, and a unified system of one-man management was established in the factories across the country. In other words, the dictatorship of the boss at work was restored. Stalin justified this in 1931, stating that we are 50 or 100 years behind the other advanced countries. We must make good this distance in 10 years. Either we do it or we shall go under. Thus, the logic of capitalist competition was restored in Stalin's Russia. Decisions were to be made once again, not on the basis of human need, but on the basis of competition with the West. This project meant a total redirection of the economy towards the production of heavy industry, leading to enormous shortages in consumer goods. And all of it was paid for by an enormous increase in grain exports while millions starved in Ukraine. Those peasants that managed to survive had their lands confiscated as they were rounded up at gunpoint and forced onto mass state-run collective farms in order to further maximize the surplus taken from them. This economic program was accompanied by the total destruction of all the social gains of the revolution. Women were forced back into the home, divorce and abortion were both banned, and the Order of Maternal Glory was created to award women who gave birth to 7 or more children. Just as sexism has always been an essential tool for the maintenance of capitalist societies, so too is it essential for Stalinist societies, as they sought to raise birth rates in order to meet the demands of their enormously expanding economies. Okay, so hopefully I've painted a fairly clear picture of how all the most important gains of the revolution were destroyed under Stalin, and why it would be totally wrong to conceptualize these societies as having anything to do with socialism. But despite the brutality of these crimes and the enormous human cost that they bear, I actually believe that this pales in comparison to the damage that Stalinism has done to the international socialist movement. I mentioned before that the Bolsheviks understood fully that the Russian Revolution was doomed to failure if it could not spread internationally. This led to the establishment of the Comintern in 1919, and yet even after Stalin abandoned this principle in 1924, he kept the Comintern alive as a tool, not for the advancement of revolutionary politics around the world, but as an instrument of Soviet foreign policy. The interests of international working class were substituted for the interests of the Russian state, and the role of communist parties was no longer to develop themselves and attempt to win revolutionary leadership over the working class, but to use their influence over workers in order to pressure their own governments into an imperialist alliance with Russia. I think there's three main ways that this political degeneration of the Comintern was shown. Firstly, the abandonment of internationalism in favor of an often stomach-churning national pride. Secondly, the development of absolutely rank class collaborationist politics that saw the workers' movement subordinated to openly bourgeois political parties. And finally, the rejection of clear anti-imperialist politics in favor of backing one more warmongering capitalist scumbag over another. All of these things meant that the Stalinist Communist Parties in the mid-20th century were by far the most effective counter-revolutionary force in the history of capitalism. The list of revolutions directly or indirectly crushed, co-opted, and sabotaged by Stalinists is far too long to go through today, so I'm going to pick a few key examples. First, the often forgotten and deliberately untaught history of the Chinese Revolution in 1925. This was the first revolution to take place in the period of the newly Stalinizing Comintern, and the earliest example of the devastating nature of such politics. Workers and peasants in China had been viciously oppressed for decades by imperialist intervention from the West and a ruling class who'd rather collaborate with the imperialists than risk any kind of movement that might give confidence to workers in fighting back against them as well. But throughout the 20s, there emerged a new and radical workers' movement in China. It challenged this status quo and quickly developed revolutionary potentials. Unfortunately, the Stalinist leadership in Russia had no interest in seeing this revolution succeed. What they wanted was to break out of their international isolation by forging alliances with any ruling class they could. A genuine workers' revolution at this point would have done little in their minds to break this isolation, and in fact, could have threatened the new order that they had finally begun to establish within Russia. The last things that the Stalinists needed was for the Russian working class to be reminded of what they had fought for in 1917 and start fighting for it again. As such, they instructed the young and inexperienced leadership of the Chinese Communist Party to join the Kuomintang, the official party of the Chinese bourgeoisie, and to essentially subordinate the struggle of the Chinese working class to something that was acceptable to their rulers. This had devastating results for the revolution. For instance, when the Communist Party led and coordinated a successful general strike and insurrection in Shanghai in 1927, winning control over the city and providing an ideal opening to spread this success to the rest of China. Instead of using this as a base from which the working class could attempt to build support across the country, the leadership of the CCP was forced against their will to literally bury their guns and hand over power to Chiang Kai-shek, the head of the Kuomintang army. Sheng was supposedly a friend of the revolution. He'd received his military training in Soviet Russia, his army was outfitted with Soviet weaponry, and the Stalinists had spent years at this point promoting him as a friend of the Chinese working class. All that counted for little, however, when Chiang Kai-shek massacred the communists in Shanghai, killing thousands of workers in the process, banning the Communist Party and the trade unions, and establishing a military dictatorship over the parts of China he controlled. Even then, the Stalinists refused to admit that their alliance, give up their alliance with the Kuomintang. They declared that they had been right to ally with Chiang Kai-shek, but that he had now turned on the revolution. And so the CCP must instead ally with the left Kuomintang, grouped around Wang Qingwei, who promptly used that support to do the exact same thing. He helped crush what remained of the Chinese workers' movement and then also turned on the CCP only a few months later. The treacherous nature of the Kuomintang was not a surprise to the leadership of the CCP themselves. In fact, they had repeatedly objected to this strategy of subordination. But the Stalinists used the authority of the Russian party, the inexperience and underconfidence of the Chinese leadership, and the fact that the CCP relied on funding from Moscow to operate as tools to leverage them into pursuing this tactic nonetheless. Thus began the Comintern's long embrace with class collaborationism. Rather than seeking to lead and encourage the working class to seize power for themselves, the Comintern saw its task as using the influence it had over workers to pressure their ruling classes into alliances with Russia. But maybe you think that the defeat of the Chinese Revolution was an accident, a case of bad advice from the Comintern, but not done with malicious intent. No such argument can be made for the Soviet intervention into the Spanish Revolution of 1936. This revolution began as a response to an attempted fascist coup by General Francisco Franco in July of 1936. Workers around the country immediately rose up in opposition to the coup and were able to drive Franco back across most of the country, including the two major cities of Madrid and Barcelona. This setback was not enough to stop Franco ever, who continued to push attempt to expand his influence over the country. In the immediate days after the coup, the bourgeois Republican government had all but collapsed and workers' power reigned in the cities. The official government refused to mobilize their troops against Franco, so workers formed their own democratic militias to organize the struggle instead. In Barcelona, where the workers' movement was the most radical, the militias went village to village, liberating people, not only from the fascists, but from the capitalists and the landlords as well. They would gather all of the debt papers up in the center of the town square, burn them in the public square, and organize democratic councils reorganize and collectivize the farmland. Likewise, the factories in the cities were seized, the capitalists were expropriated, and workers began to organize production themselves in order to fight the war. These militias fought bravely against the fascists, but often found that Franco's troops would disintegrate before they even got there, as the peasant soldiers saw that they had more to gain from joining the revolution than from crushing it. But within a few months, the revolutionary dimensions of the civil war had been all but crushed, and the capitalist government once again reigned supreme, this time filled with Communist Party ministers. Once again, the Communist Party turned its back on revolution, explicitly arguing that the fight for socialism had to wait until after the civil war, and that the task for now was to restore Spanish capitalism. That meant putting an end to the collectivization in the countryside, returning the factories into the hands of the capitalists, and brutally suppressing any resistance to this project. The most radical sections of the Spanish workers' movement were far from willing to accept this. In order to successfully carry out this task, the communists relied on an enormous amount of support from the Soviet Union. In fact, the Communist Party was initially one of the smallest of the various workers' parties. The Social Democrats and the anarchists were both an order of magnitude larger than them, and even the Trotskyists were able to rival them in some places like Barcelona. But the communists offered something to the Spanish ruling class that no other party could: guns. The communist militias were by far the best armed, trained, and outfitted, and they were extremely loyal to Spanish capitalism. The Comintern organized the International Brigade, a volunteer force of often genuinely revolutionary workers from around the world, but organized under tight Stalinist control and used more often against the other workers' parties than against the fascists. They even went as far as to send in Soviet secret police agents to abduct, torture, and execute Trotskyist anarchists and anyone else who may have gotten in the way of their goals, including Andre Nin, the founder of Spanish communism. All this paved the way for Franco's victory. He went from being totally incapable of dealing with the revolutionary offensive levied against him in 1936 to gradually conquering more and more of Spain as the revolutionary aspects of the war were destroyed and it became a much more straightforward military affair. Franco benefited from German and Italian support and was soon able to overwhelm the Soviet-backed Republicans and totally destroy any remnants of the revolution that had managed to survive. Even short of revolutions like in China and Spain, the Comintern played an absolutely terrible role in destroying the internal democracy of communist parties and subordinating everything they did to the interests of Moscow. The Communist Party of Australia is a useful case study into this. While small by European standards, the CPA was proportionally the largest communist party in the English-speaking world. And during the 30s, it gained significant influence over the Australian workers' movement through the highly successful militant minority movement, a strategy of rank-and-file union organizing that emphasized the need for class struggle and strikes and saw the communists win control over the wharfies, the iron workers, and the miners' union, while establishing a significant presence in many other unions around the country. But the CPA was unfortunately not immune to the influence of the Comintern. The fact that Australia was much less connected to the rest of the world and not a central player on the global sphere meant that it wasn't until 1929 that the Comintern intervened and had former leader Jack Kavanaugh expelled and replaced by Moscow loyalist Lance Sharkey, who maintained tight control of the party until 1965. Sharkey swung the party sharply to the left and used accusations of opportunism to drive out any critics of the Stalinist leadership. This shallow ultra-leftism was able to intersect with the radicalization brought on by the Great Depression. And the party grew substantially in the years that followed. But it also meant that they missed out on some of the greatest opportunities to relate to the radicalizing working class in this period, as they denounced the Labour Party and all its members as social fascists and refused to carry out any systematic work alongside the more genuine sections of the ALP. For instance, when the Federal Labour Party implemented a program of austerity and attempted to force the working class to pay the cost of the Great Depression, there was widespread disillusionment and hatred towards them, so much so that the New South Wales Labour Party government, led by Jack Lang, refused to go along with this program, instead paying for the crisis by refusing to pay off loans owed to the British government. Lang quickly became the most controversial man in Australia, absolutely despised by the bosses, but seen as a champion by much of the working class. To be clear, he was by no means an anti-capitalist. He was under pressure from some of the more left-wing factions within the Labour Party and saw the pathway to economic recovery as coming through government spending in order to stimulate the economy. Nonetheless, there was an explosion of working class enthusiasm around the New South Wales Labour Party, and by the end of 1931, over 180 Labour Party branches had founded what they called socialisation units, working groups within the party dedicated to bringing about socialism within 3 years. The socialisation units grew so rapidly that they soon outstripped the official membership of the Labour Party itself, there began to be serious debates within them about the need for a more revolutionary strategy. Jack Lang and the rest of the ALP leaders were scared shitless by this and soon expelled the units from the party. This should have been an ideal moment for the CPA to seriously intervene into them and could have been the basis for the formation of a genuinely mass revolutionary party. But instead, the CPA sat on the sidelines and denounced the units as left social fascists and said that they were even worse than the mainstream ALP. And then when Lang was eventually deposed by the state governor in a coup in 1932, and hundreds of thousands of workers went on strike in protest against this, the CPA did nothing to encourage those workers to keep fighting and instead focused their fire on accusing Lang and the ALP of cowardice. This faux radicalism of the CPA lasted just long enough to prevent them from taking advantage of by far the best opportunity the party had ever had to seriously present and win support for an alternative revolutionary leadership to the Australian workers' movement. But within a few short years, the directive from Moscow had changed again. By the mid-30s, Stalin had begun preparing for the prospect of another world war and sought to form an alliance with British and French imperialism in opposition to Germany. As such, the new directive issued to the communist parties in these countries was to pursue a so-called popular front. They are instructed to put aside their differences, not only with the reformists, but also with their own ruling classes, and to form electoral coalitions with the purpose of encouraging an alliance with Russia. In Australia, this meant that the CPA swung massively to the right and campaigned for the ALP in 1937 on the basis that the Conservatives weren't doing enough to prepare for war. As if to drive home the point that all of this was about nothing more than Soviet imperialist ambition, when the USSR signed a non-aggression pact with Nazi Germany and invaded Poland, Finland, and Romania, the CPA swung sharply back the other way and denounced the coming war, organizing strikes and demonstrations in opposition to British imperialism while stridently defending the conduct of the Soviet Union. Then, when the non-aggression pact was broken by Germany, the CPA swung back yet again to supporting the war, labeling it as a democratic war against fascism. And this time they went so far as to denounce strikes in the war industries, encourage their members to join the Australian army to fight for king and country. Yep. Australia was far from unique in this regard. This pattern of swinging left and then right and then left and then right again was replicated in basically every country. We've already seen the impact it had on the Spanish Revolution. In France, it meant communists joining the capitalist government, selling out strikes, and then eventually collapsing and paving the way for the Vichy regime that collaborated with the Nazis. And in America, it meant the Communist Party supporting the Democrats during the war and all but openly celebrating the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They described the atomic bomb as an awesome weapon and uncritically regurgitated the justification given by Truman for the bombing, saying that it brought a speedy end to the war. So much for the anti-imperialism that the Comintern was founded upon. So much for the idea that the working class should refuse to fight and die for their rulers. Communism now was about none of that. Rather than opposing all belligerent nations and fighting for working class power against them, communists now chose to choose one imperialist over the other. All done supposedly in the name of defending socialism, but in reality, in the defense of a brutal capitalist dictatorship. All of this might come across as just an interesting historical question, but I believe that having a clear critique of Stalinism is absolutely essential for anybody who's serious about fighting for socialism today. We have to be clear about what exactly it is that we're fighting for and what it is that we're not. We want to fight for a world of genuine working class power and democratic control. We want to fight for the liberation of humankind, and we'll never win any of those things if we think that the Stalinist societies of old have anything to do with socialism. Likewise, we have to reject the many different strategies of the old communist parties that all simply amounted to some variation of class collaboration or imperialist cheerleading. The task of socialists is to fight our rulers, not work alongside them while cheering on the bloody slaughter of millions of people in imperialist war. Our task is to reclaim the legacy of genuine revolutionary champions of the working class like Marx and Lenin and build the kind of movement free from Stalinist distortions that they spent their entire lives fighting for.